Chapter 9. Strategy or Conspiracy. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. President Dwight D. Eisenhower's 1961 Presidential Farewell Address. The Global Gulag. It is time to dig into deeper and darker places. But first, let's be clear about strategy, the logical and reasonable development of plans put together after much thought to achieve an aim. Grand strategy is arrived at after long deliberation, you'd hope, focusing on alliances with other nations, guaranteeing national survival, now for an elite few, an internationalist combiner, and seeking to ensure that the vital interests of the people are served, stopping invasions, kinetic or otherwise, you'd have thought. Policies will be agreed upon in support of the strategies, and the plans to implement them will cascade down through the system. These will be used as the basis for lower-level planning, through the extraction of the sector-relevant and level-appropriate elements by the military winning wars, not losing them, and other government departments. These bodies will select appropriate aims, like stopping subversion, and allocate resources to achieve them across the system. How they are to be achieved should be the task of the departmental bosses and their subordinates, leaving them to take the tactical decisions in line with the people's intent to increase their freedoms and to retain the liberties they have already earned, that ensure they achieve the aims they have been tasked by the electorate to accomplish. Feedback will be passed back up the chain, or should be, to tweak or significantly amend the aims and plans. But once this process is complete, the strategy can be implemented and the tactics adopted to ensure success. This is how things are supposed to work, so what makes you think that immensely powerful people outside of government don't think like this? Many do, and it's not for your benefit, it is for theirs. As well as cui bono, you have to factor in the possibility of men's rear guilty mind. Conspiracy is a criminal act, so why would intelligent plutocrats tell you what they are doing when they use their money to surreptitiously access political power? Or vice versa? If you had criminal intent, would you let on? Absolutely not, of course, so they lard their globalist intentions with words of peace, togetherness, and justice, whilst they pay to get decisions made which stagnate income for the majority as they get wealthier. Luckily, they are a tiny percentage, and we are not, so get voting. Demand direct democracy as part of your hybrid, and they can put their arguments to us, and we will take it from there. Otherwise, see below. It has been found that those with unusually high numbers of the traits of the psychopath are more likely to cluster at the top in their chosen fields. They make up about 2% of the population, and that figure is pretty much the same across all cultures. Fallon, 2014, p. 213. Thus, it is likely that a good proportion of business and other leaders at fancy forums may be genetically predisposed to be largely unaffected by the cares of others. However, they do often display great self-confidence and drive, something of use when ascending the greasy pole. This makes them good candidates for filling very trying roles, because psychopaths are by no means all serial killers, just bearers of similar but diluted traits. Fallon, 2014, pp. 214-218. To them, the means for achieving their ends are not so restricted as they are for those with a moral compass in the normal range. So, what kind of strategies do you think such people might contemplate? They won't much care about us, but they do so about themselves and the rewards that come from their access to power. In fact, a good number of them actually enjoy shafting others. The smart ones have learned to present themselves as semi-normal, canny enough to see that they cannot overstep certain boundaries. But they will know that over time, they can push them ever further than would have been accepted if they shoved them out suddenly, as in the toad in the hot water scenario. Not all are like this, but a much more significant proportion like this is found at the top than at the bottom, and it is at the top that strategic decisions are made. What do you think happens when these types of people gather and find like-minded souls with a very high regard for themselves and low opinions of those who aren't as ruthless as they are? They probably get on, sounding each other out, agreeing with a nod, a slight shake of the head, message passed, message received. Then, off to the bar, agree to a meeting in a private spot, and a plan is hatched. The author of The Psychopath Inside is one himself, and he has a high regard for Bill Clinton, the psycho's kind of guy. Dick Morris, Bill's one-time advisor, joked about him that Hillary loves Bill and Bill loves Bill. It gives them something in common. Fallon 2014, P162. However, those at the bottom have the numbers, so the wily operators at the top must tread carefully, especially as they are aware that the mass has a secret weapon, deadly to their interests if we learn to use it effectively. That weapon is the vote, though its capabilities are still not fully appreciated by most bearing it. However, those hillmen in Europe do, the damned Swiss with their hybrid democracy, giving them control of the nation's will, balancing the interests of all. They show us the way to go, and the plutocrats and the genocidal CCP the door. That is why the average Swiss is enjoying their rights and equality under the law, their better schooling coming from their control of the system, not experts whose bang for the buck in the US public system is shameful. In such organizations as the CCP, the proportion of those high on the spectrum must be off the charts, as the promotion process is selecting for those very traits, as the Polish developers of the new field of ponerology demonstrated for us. You can just imagine how the CCP types feel about the Swiss. They might like their watches, their chocolates, and their banks, but they certainly don't want the Chinese in the factories and the fields finding out about how Switzerland is governed. Not much chance of that, as the internet is as locked down as their cities often are. Knowledge is our power, and the vote is our most potent weapon when concentrated. Right, let's look at how respected figures have given their evidence concerning the conspiracies of the rich and powerful, which the media and others seem to suggest never happen. But who owns the press? Maybe when you have read this evidence, you will try to counter it with cries of fake news. I would be more than happy to be shown that my lying eyes are fooling me. However, after decades of trawling through volume after volume of history, I have come to what I believe to be a reasonable conclusion, and the pages below will detail the most significant findings and my assessment. What follows are statements and reports from infamous conspiracy theorists, including U.S. presidents, the founder of the public relations industry, a U.S. Marine Corps general who was the holder of 2 Medals of Honor, and a California governor and mega movie star. These will do for a start. Later, there will also be details from 2 assassination court cases in which juries heard a great deal of evidence, certainly more than this book can present. Of course, you can stop reading now and drop the book off at the local charity store and not have to judge what these disreputable and ill-informed sources have to say. If you are still with me, I will start with the U.S. President, Woodrow Wilson, who led the Americans into World War I. But I quote from him when he was New Jersey's governor. At that time, he was promoting the direct democratic tools of the referendum and the initiative. It must be remembered by every candid man who discusses these matters that we are contrasting the operation of the initiative and referendum not with representative government, which we possess in theory and which we have long persuaded ourselves that we possess in fact, but with the actual state of affairs, with legislative processes which are carried on in secret responding to the impulse of subsidized machines and carried through by men whose unhappiness it is to realize that they are not their own masters, but puppets in the game. Quartrup, 2021, pp. Shown 183-184. Woodrow Wilson was an academic and a bit of an oddball in several ways, but his statement is important. He was an outsider and a latecomer to the political game, and his shock is obvious when he comes to see that he and others are just fronts to fool the voters, hence his support for direct democracy. Here's one more from the conspiracy theorist, this time from his 1913 book, The New Freedom. Since I entered politics, I have chiefly had men's views confided to me privately. Some of the biggest men in the United States, in the field of commerce and manufacture, are afraid of something. They know that there is a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it. Now let's have a look at another president from the Democrats, but one who dropped the nuclear bombs on Japan, so hardly a bleeding heart liberal, President Harry Truman. This plain-speaking man established the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, in 1947 as an agency to coordinate the intelligence gathered by the various agencies reporting to him. The aim was to cut out the departmentally advantageous twists that they put on their reports by having the CIA collate them and brief him. That was the theory. However, he left a clause in the CIA's founding document that allowed it to be an active seeker of intelligence, not just a coordinator for the president's briefings, and this was seized upon by the agency's leadership. Alan Dulles went on to oversee an era of covert interventions and assassinations around the world. Eventually, following the Bay of Pigs fiasco in Cuba in 1961, he would be fired by the recently elected President John F. Kennedy. The CIA had sponsored a Cuban dissident's beach assault on the island with the aim of overthrowing Fidel Castro, almost certainly with the hope that if the beach landing showed signs of failing, that Kennedy would send in U.S. forces, which it did, but he didn't. This was another occasion in which the CIA fell for a siren song from dissidents that they wanted to believe. When it goes wrong, simply send in the Marines. More from their double Medal of Honor winner soon. The Cubans and the CIA operatives directly involved in the invasion bitterly resented Kennedy for not sending in American forces to save them and remove Castro. After seeing Dulles and others fired, they learned that Kennedy intended to defang or disband the CIA, and these vengeful operators festered and ruminated. A month to the day after Kennedy was shot, the Washington Post published Truman's concerns about the CIA, an excerpt from which is below. But there are now some searching questions that need to be answered. I, therefore, would like to see the CIA be restored to its original assignment as the intelligence arm of the president, and that whatever else it can properly perform in that special field, and that its operational duties be terminated or properly used elsewhere. We have grown up as a nation, respected for our free institutions and for our ability to maintain a free and open society. There is something about the way the CIA has been functioning that is casting a shadow over our historic position, and I feel that we need to correct it. Truman, 1963. Truman's important letter was published in the early edition of that day's Washington Post, but not its later edition. The letter was not printed in any other major daily. Why? This was a very significant event. A former president and founder of the CIA calling for its reform a month to the day after Kennedy was murdered. At the time, the message from the establishment was that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman, shooting Kennedy with a mail-order standard-issue Italian infantryman's rifle. Why should a former president at that point talk about reform of the CIA? Alan Dulles even visited Truman and asked him to rescind what he had written, but Truman refused and showed him the door. Dulles, though fired from the CIA by Kennedy, was the most influential member on the assassination investigation, the Warren Commission, of the man who fired him. You can't make this stuff up. President Truman, as diplomatically as he could, drew attention to the fact that the CIA was casting a shadow over our historic position. Douglas, 2010, pp. 331, 332, 381, 382. He understood the role they play in affairs better than anyone else in the US, except for his two successors, one of whom had just fallen under the guns in Dallas, and the other, Eisenhower, took over from him. Don't forget, it was Eisenhower who had warned the US on his departure from office of the military-industrial complex and of state organizations becoming too cozy with the corporations and organizations that they were supposed to be regulating, something so common that specialists now have a name for it: regulatory capture. Matsusaka, 2020, pp. 32, 202. Is Truman just another conspiracy theorist president saying something that the intel agencies, government, and the press will tell you is fake news? In fact, the press won't talk about it unless they have to, as they prefer to deep six anything that might start people thinking about why a former president would bring the CIA up at such a time. You don't want to start the gray matter firing up and possibly clunking into gear. Lies by omission have always been the preferred option. So far, we have looked at two Democrat U.S. presidents, both disillusioned with their ability to control the financial powerhouses and administrative state's influence on policy. Maybe Wilson is a bit too on the left for you, a man who didn't appear to like the business tycoons. Maybe you think that Truman was not implying anything about the involvement of the CIA in a U.S. president's assassination. Well, maybe you are right. So let's go to the Republican president who led the Allied forces against Hitler and was twice elected on the Republican ticket, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Maybe this third president is credible. Ike gave his famous farewell address, briefly quoted from above, when he ended his second term as president. However, he had observed the CIA's operations grow in scope and reach with killings, coups, and chaos following the agency in many of the places into which it ventured. His knowledge and understanding of their actions were thus a lot better than yours and mine. He also knew the U.S. military very well, as he had led it in its greatest operation and had seen it transformed into a force much larger and more deadly than anything the U.S. had ever previously wielded. The threat from the Soviets drove this growth, and the arms manufacturers benefited from it enormously. Taxes could easily be found to pay for these expenditures as the economy boomed, and Americans' fears were fed by the expansion of communism around the globe, evidenced by the failure of the old colonial empires to fend off the Reds. Nonetheless, Eisenhower saw the dangers in the U.S. buildup, which was rewarding shareholders with many opportunities to gouge the taxpayers. With the deployment of almost 30,000 nuclear warheads by the U.S. to counter the 4,000 or so then deployed by the Soviets, the manufacturers and suppliers became important contributors to politicians' campaigns and employers of senior ex-military personnel. The Cold War warriors, like me a couple of decades later, were then very eager to defeat communism and were receptive to the sales pitches of the whiz-bang salesman. The Bomber Boys really did cost-benefit calculations on winning with tens of millions of their own dead and deemed these acceptable if the Soviets were annihilated. Numbers, not names. In 1961, as Eisenhower prepared to depart, he put together the final draft of the speech that warned us of this growing complex. But it is often not realized that he also warned about the growth of federally funded science and the capture of the federal system itself in the interests of these groups. Sounds like he was forecasting some recent events in which the world went into lockdown and dodgy pharma sales types made a packet, no? But what did he know? As an aside, I remember when I visited Gettysburg, I passed by Ike's retirement residence, which is adjacent to the battlefield. As I recall, it was a white wood-clad complex, very modest, considering this was the home of one of America's great public figures. Times have changed. Now walled-off mansions are the norm as integrity wanes and interest in me rises, especially among the competing elite. A dissection of the mindset of these creatures can be found in a 1970s classic, The Money Game, by Adam Smith. Smith, 1976, must have a bigger boat, a more glorious waterfront property. Okay, an island with a runway then. Eisenhower's conspiratorial musings are most famously contained in this quote concerning the military-industrial complex. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together. Eisenhower, 1961. He continued to spread more fake news with his ramblings on the capture of the federal government by those it was paying handsomely. So, what did this two-term president have to tell us about the corruption of the system by money, status, and power? The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocation, and the power of money is ever-present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite. Eisenhower, 1961. As Ike said, only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can deal with this. Hence the need for a poor education system and the misdirection by the foundation gatekeepers of those with some gumption. One of the clearest statements that you will find in print regarding the control of our thoughts, perspectives, and views comes from the founder of the public relations industry, Edward Bernays. He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud and learned the power of propaganda when working for the U.S. government in their public information operation in World War I. He was a press attaché to President Wilson at the Versailles peace talks and thought that propaganda efforts honed in war could be effective in promoting peace. He may have spoken of peace, but he ended up selling bacon. Sorry, we sell the sizzle, not the bacon. Hence, we have the PR industry, which one of the industry's own handbooks admits just peddles weak propaganda, Maloney, 2006, Piagetist. This misdirection machine was founded by this expert in psychological manipulation and dissimulation, with grandiose ideas about nudging us around our open pen, like cattle working their unwitting way towards slaughter. Bernays' thinking was strategic. He didn't just promote one company when he could promote a whole industry, bigger fees, old boy. For example, he devised a campaign to get women smoking when they generally didn't. That did a lot for peace. His books and articles indicate his mindset and that of those who hired him, Crystallizing Public Opinion, 1923, Propaganda, 1928, Manipulating Public Opinion, 1928, Molding Public Opinion, 1935, The Marketing of National Policies, A Study of War Propaganda, 1942, Engineering of Consent, 1947, Human Engineering and Social Adjustment, 1979. Bernays published Propaganda in 1928, by which time he had ensconced himself as the guru in his unique branch of engineering. In the first paragraph of this slim volume, he goes straight to the heart of the matter, letting us know how the world really functions. Forget the sham your representatives talk of. Here in black and white is the reality. The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country. Bernays, 1928, p. 37. Honestly, it is the first paragraph, no need to read more. If that is not clear enough, Winston Churchill stated, "There is no such thing as public opinion. There is only published opinion." Don't forget, Bernays advised the largest corporations in the U.S. and the government itself, at one point backing the overthrow of the government of Guatemala by the CIA. At the time, he was the chief PR man for the United Fruit Company, Chiquita Brands, which owned 42% of the land there, and they didn't appreciate the elected government's policies. Bernays, 2021, PP Shaw 11, 12. This neatly leads us to the experiences of the highly decorated U.S. Marine Corps officer I mentioned previously, who routinely had been involved in such operations as Bernays desired be undertaken in Guatemala. You won't find movies about this hero because he wrote War is a racket to expose the use of the military to enforce the will of the moneyed elite. Hardly edifying, as he explains, I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period, I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and the bankers. Clear enough so far? He continued, "In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico, and especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. Sound familiar? This is a retired U.S. general writing. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers in 1902-1912. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents." Harris, 2020, p. 104. Those local constraints were ignored once the CIA was established, Monroe Doctrine for everyone else to be bound by, but no such thing as a sphere of influence for the three-letter boys and the banks. An Iranian leader removed, genocides abetted, and ignored in Indonesia, courtesy of the CIA. Blum, 2003, pp. 193, 198, and in Bangladesh, courtesy of President Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. The latter, bowing to the advice of his guru, Nelson Rockefeller, and toadying to Nixon in support of Pakistan and its genocide, by some accounts, of up to 3 million, mainly Hindus, as Bangladeshis sought to free themselves from their West Pakistan overseers. Base, 2014. By the way, that's the same New York State Governor Rockefeller who advised JFK to nuke the Vietnamese. Yes, that's on the White House tapes. Douglas, 2010, p. 320. They don't record there anymore. So we've had presidents, one of America's most decorated war heroes and the most well-known PR man who ever lived, letting us know that there is an elite hiding in plain sight and pulling the strings, running the military-industrial complex and America's foreign affairs and wars. Now, we move on to one of America's most famous movie stars who became California's governor, Arnie, explaining how the crooked elite in California was controlled by using direct democracy, as Dicey advised. Yes, through the introduction of the tools that this book is aimed at seeing used in a constituency near you. Mr. Schwarzenegger, action. The ballot initiative system dates back to Hiram Johnson, California's legendary governor from 1911 to 1917. he used it to break up the power of a corrupt legislature controlled by giant railroads. Quartrup, 2021, PA 181. I won't delve too deeply into the machinations of the hard left, as their program has been completely discredited, leaving the imperfect version of representative democracy as the only alternative they want you and me to know about. Hence my comparison of representative and direct democracy, with the real choice being neither, but both combined in ways that benefit us most, the hybrid solution to our endless ills. How many from the right, let alone the revolutionary left, have you seen propose more democracy, not less? Have you ever heard a Labour or Democrat politician or a Conservative or Republican point you in the direction of a Swiss hybrid? They are not in denial. They are in terror of the successful trial in the Alps. The results are in, and they dare not draw your eyes towards them. They all failed us, and it is time we moved on towards the mountains, so let's take the high road. However, as a quick fix for the Stalinists, Trotskyists, and other losers, the committed control freaks morphed and doubled down on their subversion of systems on either side of the Atlantic. Lots of communist-inclined types have found a friendly reception in the parties of the centre-left, which always had its share of the hard-left infiltrators anyway. Now they just have more. To understand their mindset, I can recommend a classic on how they systematically infiltrated institutions in the past, a work of a former communist. The organizational weapon is dated now, but Philip Ziegler wrote from experience on their methods and their unfortunate genius for the covert takeover and control of the institutions that they targeted. Look around you, and you can see the evidence of the same techniques being used today, but I will leave you to decide. Ziegler refers to the organization as the Combat Party, as it makes great demands on its members. The party comes first, and its thirst for power cannot be slaked. For communists, the seizure of power somewhere is always on the agenda. Ziegler, 1960, p. 13. And they have a plan, and not a democratic one. The construction of a Bolshevik party consolidates the communist elite, readies it for action. This vanguard, however, can fulfill its function and indeed sustain itself only as it finds a way to the sources of power. In meeting this need, the communist movement has before it an image of a manipulable mass, a great potential source of energy which can be mastered by those who have the knowledge and the will to do so. The problem is then one of strategy and tactics, how to make best use of the combat party, and especially how to manipulate groups and institutions that lie outside the constitutionally controlled arenas of the struggle for power. These techniques are not randomly selected. They depend on the nature of the tools to be used, as well as on the goal of total power. Ziegler, 1960, Piers 53. Total power, that's the game. Another insider's account of the deep penetration methods of the Reds is that covering the Soviet illegals that worked hand in glove with American communists, and this can be found in witness by a former editor of Time magazine, the previously noted Whittaker Chambers. Chambers, 1980. His sensational testimony saw the imprisonment of Alger Hiss, a one-time advisor to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. As Chambers noted, in a situation with few parallels in history, the agents of an enemy power were in a position to do much more than purloin documents. They were in a position to influence the nation's foreign policy in the interests of the nation's chief enemy. Chambers, 1980, PSIR 427. Roosevelt's administration was loaded up with communists and their sympathizers, but don't believe me, read Perjury by Alan Weinstein, Weinstein, 1978, who was a Democrat-supporting journalist who did not believe that Hiss was guilty, that is, until the end of his detailed and famous investigation when he accepted the evidence against Hiss. But the body of available evidence proves that he did, in fact, perjure himself when describing his secret dealings with Chambers, so that the jurors in the second trial made no mistake in finding Alger Hiss guilty as charged. Weinstein, 1978, p. 565. Not that the left will admit that, but then they supported Stalin literally months after he got through killing millions of Ukrainians. Odd that, when looking at Hunter and Joe Biden today, and the Democrats making hooky with the same genocide sufferers FDR and his authoritarian admiring crew ignored back in the 1930s. I give some leeway to those who stepped forward to combat the Nazis as they rose in Germany, but those who continued their support after the Hitler-Stalin Pact weeks before Germany invaded Poland get none. Don't forget, they are one-track political animals, so if their lips are moving, they are probably lying. If it damages the opposition, it is good. If not, find something else that does. Unmasked by Andy Ngo, 2021, is a more up-to-date and equally useful read, covering one of the more recently active organizations busy undermining and attacking your democratic rights, Antifa. They are a well-organized and well-funded group of groups, not so spontaneous as one might assume for an imaginary organization, according to Jerry Nadler, DNY. Ngo, 2021, p. 6. Who funds them? Why does law enforcement treat their riots and killings so differently from the activities of the Trumpsters? Getting these books under your belt will make things a lot clearer to you, giving you most of what you need to know about the continuing threat that democracy faces from dangerous internal forces. Try and talk to an Antifa type about improving democracy, and you may find yourself covered in spittle as they froth in your face and try to intimidate you, which is not unusual behavior in the self-righteous and disturbed types who often join such cults. I remember reading an excellent book on the intellectual life of the British working class, which noted that the workers in the 1920s and 1930s had a problem with the Marxists themselves, as they found them to be dogmatic and selfish. Rose, 2021, p. 298. Nothing's changed there. It's interesting that fake news has become a big item in the mainstream media only after much of their audience lost faith in their coverage. Governments are getting in on the act because they are being prompted to do so, because the people are not swallowing the messaging as they used to, so they are trying to nudge and cow us into submission. The nudge units are rolling out the usual influencer techniques, abusive psychology, fear-mongering, and fake news, just as the ponerologists observed the bureaucrats doing in the former. Soviet Union, as the Russians say, the past is unpredictable. This desperate reset rubbish has woken a slumbering giant that the mass handlers thought that they had fooled with their soporific schooling and through pushing attention, improving, mind-numbing drugs. However, many of them have shaken off their lethargy and noted the lies, the false claims, and the bullshit that governments have liberally sprayed about in a desperate attempt to baffle us. Well, it's not working, and we don't yet live with the boot of the CCP's goons crashing down again and again onto our faces. But if we do not take control of our destiny, the global control freaks will.